Tonight on Arena, Poster Boys, an uncle-nephew road movie for the Galway Film Flam, and celebrating the 104th birthday of Olivia de Havilland. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, you know festival time is upon us when the Galway Film Fla draws into view. All has changed utterly on the 2020 festival circuit, of course, and the Film Fla will this year give us an online offering from Tuesday, July the 7th through until Sunday, July the 12th. Among the films to be seen during the festival is the documentary The Eighth, tracing Ireland's campaign to remove the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, Mark O'Halloran's drama Rialto, which he spoke to us about on Friday night when he was on with us, and Tom Sullivan's famine story Arrocht. But tonight, I'm joined by the writer and director of the film Poster Boys, Dave Minogue, which will be available on day one of the festival. And I believe, Dave, this film started out as a kind of a bet that you that you took on back in the film, back at the Film Fla in 2018.
the one of the sweetest things in life is proving people wrong. And Owen McKenna, who's a producer on this, he bet me I couldn't finish the film by the start of September that year. And well, he was half right. We finished most of it. And then when he saw an early cut, he was like, this is pretty good. And he apologized and said, you're wrong, Dave. Or I'm wrong, Dave. And then he made me go back and shoot a good bit more. And now we're finally finished. And we're premiering in a few days.
All right. Was it a big bet, by the way? Or did you just decide then when he saw the first very rough cut, albeit not totally finished, were all bets cancelled at that point?
I don't know. He was all in. He saw it and he was like, okay, this is good. We're gonna make this as best as we can. And then it's been kind of a team effort for the past year. We've stopped being rivals and we're champions.
We're champions. Okay. Well, the Poster Boys, a comedy, down at heel man at the centre of it all, a character called Al Clancy, played by Trevor O'Connell. It's a nephew, and the nephew, Carl, his nephew, Carl, who he has to look after for a week. It's the two of them. It's a road movie between an uncle and a nephew. That's a new take on this genre. But I believe you have a real life inspiration here.
Yeah, my nephew plays Carl, my nephew, Ryan. He's we were at home. I went home and we were watching Spider-Man. And afterwards, he's a friend. He's a friend more than anything. And it was afterwards, I was kind of like, what is this relationship? Like, how most people, not everyone has an uncle, and it's kind of an undefined relationship. And I just wanted to explore that. So it just was an idea that I just couldn't get out of my head. And then it just developed into something that's now real. And Ryan was the first person I asked. I sent a message to him, asked him, would he be interested in doing something like this? And he didn't know what he was getting in for, but he joined and he knocked it out of the park.
And I believe, in fact, you know, it's often the story with films that it's the availability of the star that can dictate shoot dates, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Ryan's availability was an issue here, was it?
Yeah, well, at first I was told it couldn't conflict with his either his social life or his soccer training schedule. And then it was school as well, as summer. As summer was coming to an end, it was like, he obviously has to go back to school. So that's where we had to shoot before September began.
All right. That was in the days when children actually went out of the house and went to school at that point in time.
In my day, we used to go to school.
We did no staying at home looking at a computer and pretending you were in school. Although no parents will thank you for that particular type of schooling, I'm sure. Listen, let's listen to a clip from Poster Boys, because lots of the things you're talking about, in fact, make their way into the story. And in this clip that we're about to listen to, Al and his nephew are on the road in Carl's mother's camper van. Carl being the nephew, that is. Al gets a call from Carl's teacher, and Al is rather sweet on the teacher.
This is from your teacher. He needs to finish the maths work from last week, read chapter 2 and 3 of the book, and catch up on his spelling.
Did you just get a text from my teacher giving me homework?
Yep.
How does she have your number?
We matched on Tinder.
You matched my teacher on Tinder. Now she's giving you homework assignments through you.
Yep.
Are you insane?
What? What's the big deal?
You don't get it. She's out to ruin my life.
By making sure you're well educated.
I can't believe you've done this to me. This is the most messed up thing ever.
Why?
You don't get it. She's using you.
Using me?
To give me homework. How messed up is that? She's a psychopath, Al. A psychopath.
I think you should get started on your maths.
In fact, he gets a text there from the beginning, and there's a very brief conversation with the teacher where it's very clear that his interest in the teacher is not around education, the education of his nephew at any rate. That's Trevor O'Connell there as Al, yeah. And Ryan Minogue Lee as Carl, Al's nephew in Poster Boys. And speaking with me this evening is Dave Minogue, the director of the film, whose nephew is Carl, or is Ryan Minogue Lee. It sounds to me, I don't know how much you had to draw out of Ryan to get that style of bolshiness that he has bossing adults around and a rather precocious nature. Was that easy to find within him and for him to find?
He had to dig deep. No, that's Ryan inherently. The key to getting a good natural performance from a kid like that would be to let them be themselves and let them feel free to be themselves. So the world that the film is constructed around that kind of environment, and we created that environment on set, maybe a bit too much. He ended up kind of running the show and kind of telling us when he had enough, and like you're going for another take. He's like, Dave, I think you have it. Let's move on. And or he'd start doing these things like where he would save his performance for his close-up, meaning that when we're in the edit, we have to use his close-ups a bit more often than we might prefer.
And that's lordy.
And the worst thing is, he doesn't even want to be an actor. He's going to be like an architect or an engineer or socket bearer. He has no real intention of being an actor, but he's the star.
I'd certainly was throwing his weight around the place, it sounds there. But I mean, obviously himself and Trevor O'Connell are at the very heart of the movie, but you've quite a cast here. Keith Duffy makes an appearance, Norma Sheehan is in there, Amy Hughes plays the aforementioned teacher, and Bobby Kerr, who is one of your producers, he's in the ice cream sales scene as well. Was that one of the conditions? He gave you a bit of seed money really for this. That was how it worked, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bobby was great. Bobby kind of made the whole thing happen. And he was like, one condition, you make me a star. I was like, Bobby, anything for you, Bobs. And then it's just one of those things that literally built, it just started happening before we kind of realized it. And the crew came on instantly, and we were so lucky to have such a great crew. And they've been with it throughout. It's not a well-funded film by any means. And everyone's just kind of got behind the project. So it's really all of our film. And I couldn't be luckier or more humble about it. I just feel it's everyone's thing.
And I guess the important thing, I suppose, just going back to the Carl character for the time being, the nephew character, it's not just that he, that he's a bit of a smart aleck and that he's precocious and all the rest, but he really does teach the character of Al a few lessons. I mean, he teaches him how to be responsible. He teaches him probably, in fact, how to be more of an adult than Al, the uncle, has been to date. Have you had that experience with your nephew where from the mouths of a young fella came words of wisdom?
In its own way. Ryan has always been quite a shoot. The character is actually it's two characters. Ryan has a little sister, Abby, and the two of them are wicked smart, and they don't let anyone away with anything. So it's kind of based on the two of them and merged into one. And I wouldn't say I've had any mad life-changing I suppose we've made a film together, it's a bit life-changing there.
Yeah.
But I haven't had any. He hasn't saved my life in the same way that Carl has. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, there's a sequence during what will be the end credits, because I saw a rough cut of it earlier today. The sequence in the end credits where they're in the camper van, which is a big part of the story, obviously. And it sounds to me as if Trevor O'Connell, the character who plays Al Clancy, and Ryan, who played by your nephew Ryan, that they're actually improvising around accents. Was that in the script, or is that just an outtake that you managed to get the audio of it?
The night before, when I was driving Ryan home, we had that conversation, and I was like, this is hilarious. I've got to put this in. But Trev and Ryan, like the two of them together, like what you see on the screen, that's how they were the whole time. Trev was amazing with him and just kind of really helped him get out of his shell and kind of taught him a few little acting techniques and stuff. He was brilliant. Like, we were so lucky to have someone like Trev to come on board with this, because like Ryan is full of energy. He's like either asleep or he's bouncing off the walls. And Trev really, he really stepped in to kind of mentor him how to act as well.
Well, so much so that, you know, when I'm talking to you tonight, Dave Minogue, the uncle of the actor, I think I'm talking to Trevor O'Connell, you know, because there really was an uncle-nephew feel off them, you know. It was very nice in that respect, and a real good feel-good feel to it. I think it's a bit of a dark turn towards the end, but let's leave that for people to see when they get there. But congrats, Dave, and I'm sure you're delighted to be
to be there
on the opening day of the Galway Film Flat. That's Dave Minogue, director there of Poster Boys at the Galway Film Flat, the online version, which starts on Tuesday the 7th of July, and the flat runs online from the 7th right through until Sunday the July the 12th, and you can find out full information on galwayfilmfla.ie. When the Adelphi Cinema opened on Dublin's Abbey Street in January 1939, the first audiences through the door were entertained by one of the great blockbusters of the era. The man playing the title role in Robin Hood was Hollywood legend Errol Flynn, and alongside him playing Maid Marian, a 22-year-old actress who was already on track to legendary status herself. That is Olivia de Havilland. Today, July the 1st, that actress celebrates her 104th birthday.
And you're leaving here at once. Please, darling, every minute you're here, you're in danger.
Okay. Marion, I wonder, will you come with me?
To Sherwood?
I've nothing to offer you but a life of hardship and danger, but we'd be together.
Because I love you, Robin, I'd come. Even the danger would mean nothing if you were with me.
And there we go, Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn in a clip there from The Adventures of Robin Hood, kind of Titanic, I suppose, of its day in terms of the romance that goes between the two characters, Robin Hood and Maid Marian, as she might have been referred to. A movie that cemented de Havilland's status as an A-list star in the golden age of Hollywood. Today, July the 1st, we celebrate Olivia de Havilland's 104th birthday, on the off chance that Ms. de Havilland might be listening in France as we speak. I would like to wish her a very happy birthday, and anybody that knows her can pass that on. I'm sure I would be in a long queue of people who would like to pass those greetings on to her. But to help us remember her career and talk a little bit about her, Ruth Barton is with me this evening. An extraordinary Ruth to think of that. She's hearty and healthy, we believe. A household name even before World War II broke out. She must be the last surviving star of that golden age of Hollywood, is she?
Well, I would have certainly thought so at 104. And happy birthday, Olivia. And I think actually pink champagne is in order. It's apparently one of the things that's kept her going so remarkably well. I don't know anybody else. I can't think of anybody else who's older than Olivia de Havilland. Mm. Actually, many people who are older than Olivia de Havilland. But yeah, she is a star of the Hollywood Golden Age, which is extraordinary.
It started right back in Tokyo, obviously, in 1916 for Olivia de Havilland. Her sister came along a few years later. And that's a very important part of the story, the two sisters. Their mother was determined early on that the two girls were going to have a career in show business. Is that right?
Yeah, her mother herself had acting ambitions and did return to the stage later on. And she seems to have been, well, later on was blamed, certainly by Joan, for being very pushy and for having huge ambitions for her two daughters. But of course, what most people remember from the Olivia and Joan relationship is the very, very public disagreements, to put it mildly, between the two.
Yeah.
And as much as Olivia was getting newspaper headlines for her career as an actor, for her you know, large part of her life. So was her sister, and much of it was about the, you know, the fights between the two.
Yeah, well, we'll come back a little bit to that rivalry a little bit later on, but let's concentrate on the career of the birthday woman herself. She was 19 when she starred in a Shakespeare stage production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it really exploded from there. An immediate partnership with Errol Flynn. He was a big star at that stage in the mid-1930s.
Yes, he was. I mean, she started off with Max Reinhardt, who was a name to remember from the theatre world. And she started off in the Hollywood Bowl on the stage production and then landed the role in Midsummer Night's Dream in 1935. But in order to play that, she had to sign a contract with Warners. And Errol Flynn was already signed up with Warners. So, yes, he was established, but they were both very, very young. There wasn't a huge age difference. So. You know, in the kind of first film together, which is Captain Blood, in which he actually plays an Irish character, neither of them was very well known, but this screen chemistry, and indeed off-screen chemistry too, really sparked something between the two of them. They became just this massive kind of couple, duo on screen. And they were in 8 films together for Warners, an incredible kind of professional pairing.
But in some ways, the 8 films were just 8 versions of the same story. Certainly the same kind of dynamic between the two leading characters.
They certainly were. And I mean, I watched The Adventures of Robin Hood the other day, and the film is really about Errol Flynn. You know, it's about looking at Robin Hood, and he's, you know, prancing around in his flamboyant green tights. And this is the kind of pattern for all the films, that these are action pictures. They're about a macho male hero who has many, many adventures, and in and out of the story comes this, you know, strong woman, but she's kind of always sidelined, but she's there waiting for him. And then she falls, as we heard in that clip, swooning into his arms at the very end of the film, and they ride off into the sunset having dispatched the villain.
Yeah, swoons, I think, were de rigueur in the 1930s.
And much swooning went on, yeah.
a lot of it, right enough. But I suppose the interesting thing about that Warner contract, there must have been some kind of exclusivity clause within it, but she also managed to swing the part of Melanie in Gone with the Wind, David O. Selznick production. How did she, you know, wangle her way or get her way around the restrictions that might have been there around her Warner contract?
She was very feisty. I mean, she played the good girl on screen, and in Gone with the Wind, people will remember she's Melanie, and she's, you know, Melanie's the good cousin who leads a decorous life compared to Scarlett O'Hara. But in real life, she was very tough. And so, you know, by the time Gone with the Wind was being kind of mooted around town, she really was interested in the part. And, well, according to Joan Fontaine, Joan Fontaine said she already tried out for Melanie, but she turned up for the she turned up for the audition looking too glamorous. So she said, "Oh well, I'll take my sister then." But that's not the way that Olivia tells it. Yeah. Olivia said no, that she really, really wanted this, and she knew that she was Melanie, and so she. She tried to get out of her contract with Warners. Jack Warner wouldn't let her. So then she contacted Warner's wife and tried with her, a sort of woman to woman. And eventually she managed to get through to David O. Selznick and got the part very quickly after that.
In fact, there was a documentary made in 2004, a documentary called Melanie Remembers, where Olivia de Havilland recalled that desire to play the character of Melanie. Here, have a listen to her reflections on that.
In the summer of 1936, the entire world was reading Margaret Mitchell's book, and I was doing the same thing. It was the character of Melanie that attracted me most, because of her admirable qualities and the values that meant so much to her and meant so much to me. I wanted to perpetuate these values. And the perfect way to do that, of course, would be to play the role of Melanie.
That's Olivia de Havilland in a 2004 documentary, Melanie Remembers, and she's reflecting there on why she wanted to play that character in Gone with the Wind. Because in some ways, Ruth Barton, who's with me this evening to celebrate the 104th birthday of Olivia de Havilland, in some ways, you know, it's often the harder part to play the goody-goody two-shoes. Did she embrace that across other roles as well?
Yes, she often played. She often played the good girl. I mean, she certainly does in with the Robin, you know, the Robin of the Errol Flynn pairings, and she goes on, you know, to play, you know, films like The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex, which was again she in that she was with Errol Flynn, but in fact the pair there was in fact Betty Davis and Errol Flynn, and she goes on. Well, The Great Garrick, she played comedy. But then in Hold Back the Dawn, which is, you know, a slightly later film, she plays opposite Charles Boyer. Again, she's the kind of moral, she's the moral core of the film. So that was very much the kind of role assigned to her. And but what I think is very interesting about her is, and perhaps also the choices, and by the time sort of mid-century, she was beginning to be able to make her own choices rather than always having to take the roles that were on offer. The directors she's working with begin to slightly play on that. And so you're beginning to get much more complex films mid-century, and films where, for me, the best example is a film called The Heiress, which is just an absolutely fantastic film, directed by William Wyler. And in that, she is, you know, the Plain Jane. It's an adaptation, in fact, of Washington Square, the Henry James story. So she's the Plain Jane daughter of this eminent doctor. He is constantly comparing, the doctor constantly compares her unfavourably with her mother, and she's very demure apparently, and she can barely look at the young man who approaches her at the ball and asks, you know, asks her for a dance. He's played by Montgomery Clift. And so at the beginning you think, oh yes, this is, you know, here we go again almost. But actually, as the film develops and as the odds kind of stack against her in terms of actually getting married, and her father keeps putting her down, he's played by Ralph Richardson. It's absolutely brilliant because he's an eminent doctor. He's not a monster, and yet he's monstrous. And she's, you know, in the beginning she kind of hangs back and she can barely make eye contact. As the film develops, as things go against her, she gets tougher and tougher and tougher. Until the ending, and then she just, you know, she just lets rip. So there is it's a really interesting watching her career develop from those very early kind of demure roles, the Melanies and so on, right up to the later parts.
Well, I was going to go to something about the rivalry, but let me skip that that talk about the rivalry just for the time being and go to the clip, in fact, from The Heiress, which has, as you say, Olivia de Havilland as this character who is fighting to maintain her inheritance. In fact, that's what she's looking for, and this is a scene which features her with her. It's her aunt, isn't it, that she's speaking to here?
Aunt Lavinia, who's played by Miriam Hopkins.
Right. Well, let's have a listen then. Olivia de Havilland, naive heiress Catherine Sloper, fallen for Morris Townsend, as you said, Ruth, played by Montgomery Clift. And in this scene, she's speaking to her aunt, Lavinia Pennyman, played by Miriam Hopkins. And Morris Townsend has failed to show up. Aunt Lavinia knows why.
Why shouldn't I have told him?
Morris would not want to be the cause of your losing your natural inheritance. He could not see you impoverished.
Impoverished? I have 10,000 a year. That is a great deal of money.
Not when one has expected 30.
You think what my father thinks. Well, you are wrong. Morris loves me. I am everything he ever yearned for in a woman.
Oh, Catherine.
I am. He has told me so. He thinks I am pretty. He wants me. He could not wait for tomorrow night. He said we must go tonight.
No, I said that, didn't I?
But he agreed. He was willing. You can see that for yourself. He was very willing.
Well, then, perhaps he will come.
Perhaps. He must come. He must take me away. He must love me. He must.
Catherine, please, take hold of yourself.
No, no, Morris must take hold of me. Morris will love me. For all those who didn't.
There we go. Olivia de Havilland as Catherine Sloper and Miriam Hopkins playing her aunt Lavinia in that clip from The Heiress. Ruth Barton with us this evening celebrating the 104th birthday of Olivia de Havilland. Let's go back to that discussion around the rivalry between the sisters. How bad was it really, Ruth? And how you know, I think it was there from very early on.
And very certainly it made headlines and blown up by the media. What seems to have been the kind of reality is that no, they didn't get on and off. But for every fight that they had, they also made up. So you know, throughout their life, and I mean, both of them lived very, very, you know, very, very long. I mean, so did Joan Fontaine. She died. I mean, Joan Fontaine only died in 2013. So throughout both their very long lives, they fought, they made up, they fought, they made up. And they often actually spent time together perfectly amicably. They fought, they made up right until their own mother died. And that seems to have been the final break, because when their mother died, Olivia de Havilland was close by. Joan Fontaine was touring. Olivia de Havilland apparently didn't mention to Joan Fontaine that the cremation was on. And basically, Joan Fontaine turned up too late, and that was the final rift between the two sisters.
Well, interesting that it should have been around the parents that was the final breakup, because in a 1977 interview with Jean Thomas, Joan Fontaine was being interviewed here, and the interviewer asks Joan about the sibling rivalry. When did it begin? And it started very early.
I really think it happened when I was born. My sister being a little older than I was, we were born in the Orient and we had armors and all that sort of thing. I was a sick little child and I don't think Olivia was allowed in my nursery. And then I think she rebelled and wouldn't come in even. And it started there, that kind of, not, we can't even say sibling rivalry yet. But it was not helped. We are highly motivated and our parents and people around us brought us up with a point of view of vying, you can, she can't kind of thing, contest. That makes for achievers. It's a marvelous thing that way, but it doesn't make for a particular close bond, because we were rivals long before we thought of being actresses. It was the way we were brought up, and I'm sorry about it. I wish it hadn't been so.
That's terribly sad to hear Joan Fontaine speaking there in an interview in the 1970s about her relationship with her sister, Olivia de Havilland. Olivia de Havilland celebrating her 104th birthday today. It is very sad, Ruth Barton, to hear that a sister express sentiment in that way. But I guess Olivia de Havilland was well capable of dishing out her own side of things. And she has, had certainly, a very litigious streak, up until very recently, in fact. 2 years ago, when she sued the makers of Feud, a docudrama about a rivalry between Joan Crawford and Bette Davis. And ironically, it was around something that was said about her sister, Joan Fontaine.
Yeah, this is quite remarkable. Yeah, 2017. So she was past 100 at that stage. And some people may remember having watched on TV the Ryan Murphy production, Feud, Betty and Joan, which was obviously had, you know, ancillary characters, and obviously, and again, one of them is Olivia de Havilland. She was played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, and as part of the script, Catherine Zeta-Jones as Olivia refers to Joan Fontaine as my bitch sister, and Olivia instantly sued them and said, "I didn't use the word bitch." And this went through the courts. Her case was thrown out. She appealed. It was thrown out. And eventually, for actually about the first time in a very litigious life, she lost this one, which was also, it was a big win for documentary filmmakers who would have had to have been very circumspect in terms of portraying real people on the screen if she had won.
I suppose the important one that she did win was the one that was referred to as the de Havilland ruling, very important for all actors subsequently, really.
Yeah, that was the case she took against Warners, and she was a number of people. In fact, her good friend Betty Davis was another who really, really chafed against the studio system, where they had to take whatever role they were assigned to. And she, throughout her 7-year contract with Warners, consistently refused to take roles. So when she finished with them, they said, ah, but you've got 7 months left for all those times that you refused to work. And she said, no, I had a 7-year contract with you. I'm not working out those months that I didn't work. And she took them to court and she won. And that became very, very, a very famous a case, because it's really one of the things that brought down the Hollywood studio system, and it became called the de Havilland ruling, and she became a free agent after that, which was very unusual for those days.
Her career went into something of a hibernation during the 1950s. Why was that?
I hate to say. In part because of the, I mean, again, the collapse of the studio system meant that actors didn't get the regular roles that they got. But don't forget, by this stage, she was past 30, which then was considered to be over the hill. So she came and went. She also had, by this stage, she'd married twice. She had 2 children, one from each marriage. She was very devoted to her children, and she moved to live in Paris, though she was always, you know, going backwards and forwards between Paris and America. So the roles really didn't appear, though. I mean, she did have some fantastic roles in later life. I'm not certain if you'd call Airport 77 one of them, but there were others.
particularly,
and she also did quite a lot of TV.
Hush, Hush, Sweet Caroline was a big one in 1964.
She was pretty nasty
in that.
That's the one to remember her by. In, you know, this is the one where she finally puts the good girl image to bed, because she is just wicked as Cousin Miriam, playing opposite Betty Davis.
I hope she's having a wicked 104th birthday party with lots of pink champagne wherever she is in France. And thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Ruth Barton there talking to us about the Hollywood screen legend Olivia de Havilland, who celebrates her 104th birthday today. How we look and how we see lie at the heart of the playful, mind-altering installations and video art made by Paris-based artists Anne Cleary and Dennis Connolly, the first Irish artists to have their own exhibition at the Pompidou Centre. They've also shown in the Barbican, the Tate Modern in London, and many major galleries here in Ireland. They're currently working on a new show, Vision Revolution, the Invisible Light exhibition for the Crawford Gallery in Cork. That will take place in October. And you can see them online this weekend at this year's Clonmel Junction Arts Festival, where they are giving a series of 7 lectures, also called Vision Revolution. And Anne Cleary and Dennis Connolly join me now on the line from La Rochelle. Lucky for them to be there. Maybe heading to Paris to Olivia de Havilland's birthday party later on. I don't know. Most artists in any art form, I suppose, are aware of their audience to some degree. But your practice, Anne, it really places the viewer front and centre. I'm thinking of installations like Change Your Stripes, which is here in Dublin last year, or The Colour of Time, which you had in Clonmel, in fact, 2 years ago. Talk to me a little bit about that idea of putting the viewer front and centre, and how you did that in those particular installations.
Well, so the spectator has always been the most important element of our work for many, many years. When we moved to Paris in 1990, Dennis and I, we were young architects, and we spent a lot of time looking at art. We were very, very interested in art ourselves, both of us. And so we spent many years going to galleries and looking at art. And then when we started to make art ourselves, that relationship became the central idea of the work. The reason for this is that we felt that we asked ourselves, does art really exist if nobody's looking at it? You know, this whole idea of a painting or a work of art existing for itself didn't seem to make a lot of sense to us. And we felt that really, you know, the piece didn't really exist until somebody was there looking at it. And so we started to think about ways that we might, you know, develop that relationship with the spectator. And so we started to play around with interactive technology to see, could we put the person right there in the center of the work? And so from that point of view, for example, we developed a piece called Change Your Stripes, which was in Dublin last year. And Change Your Stripes, what it does, when it's at rest, when nobody's there looking at it or intervening in it, it's just an array of black and white stripes, and they undulate slightly. But if somebody intervenes in the work, it picks up that person's silhouette and it redistributes it, it plays with it and it projects it and moves it through the work. So it becomes a sort of a living work of art.
So you really have to look at what's happening in front of your eyes, because it's happening in that moment. It's not as if you can say, oh, I'll just do that again and see what happened, because it might happen differently the next time round.
That's it, exactly. And there's a kind of spontaneity built into the work. So it will be different the next time around. So every gesture that you make will transform the artwork in a different way.
I guess the background that Anne has just described to me, Dennis, there, the background in architecture, there's a kind of a scientific side to that as well as an artistic side. And that in some ways, I think, explains part of your dual approach to the works that you do. The seven talks that you're giving in Clonmel relate directly to the upcoming exhibition, which, as I mentioned, it'll be in the Crawford Gallery in Cork this autumn. Now, you're exploring the electromagnetic spectrum. That's a big subject. All the light visible and invisible in the entire universe, infrared, ultraviolet, microwaves, etc. Now, how do you change the science, or how do you even start thinking and moving from scientific terms to visual terms to artistic terms? Or are they much closer than I think?
No, they're not. They're not so close. And you know, as artists, we often ignore the science on this. And by focusing on invisible light, you know, most of the light that's in the universe is invisible. There's only a small band of it that's visible right at the center of the spectrum. And by looking beyond that, we've had to open a lot of dialogue with science, because most of these subjects are created for us by science, and are covered by science, and are made available to us by science. And mostly as artists, we haven't really, although there's a few exceptions, we haven't really taken them on. So, you know, for example, X-rays, which are a form of invisible light, have become something in medicine and in security, but not really something in art. Although they're now visible to us, just like visible light is, because we've created technologies to make them visible. And we're well used to that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. How do we experience then, in essentially a visual artist, a visually artistic medium, how do we experience something that we can't see? Is that what you're looking at, finding ways that we experience it that maybe aren't just visual?
Yes, exactly. So I mean, all of these, we could, when we say the vision revolution, where we're talking about all of these forms of invisible light that this revolution has made visible to us through various means. But most of those, it's a scientific revolution, and there's been different technologies and different methods we've found to make those forms of light visible, but also to make the things that we can see with those. That's the significance. And, you know, everybody's familiar with X-rays, but what you might not be familiar with is how microwaves make it possible to look back in time, to look right back to the beginning of time, because there's light coming to us from the beginning of time in the form of microwaves. And we don't usually think of microwaves as visible. We think of them as a sort of radio wave, like a sort of form of communication. In fact, a lot of our communication happens through microwaves. Now, especially with Wi-Fi, but in fact, in this case, it's a visible light that started off as visible, and because it's come from the beginning of the universe, it slowly changed. It got longer and longer until it became microwaves.
So, on one hand, we're looking at a very modern and contemporary exhibition, but we're looking at a contemporary exhibition that's bringing us back into the mists of time, prehistoric time, and almost pre-universal time in some ways, from what you're telling us there, Dennis. Vision Revolution also honours John Tyndall, an Irish scientist, probably better known in his own lifetime of the 19th century than he is today. Tell us a little bit about him, Anne.
Yeah, so John Tyndall is really Ireland's universal man in a way, in the same way as Leonardo da Vinci is for the Italians, because he was an incredible scientist, but also he was a fantastic writer and an incredible draftsman, and also an alpinist. And he climbed the Alps, and a lot of his discoveries came from that experience climbing the Alps. So he was very interested in the way glaciers melted. And so he was observing different processes, you know, that involved accumulated heat. And he became aware that in certain circumstances, perhaps when it was cloudy, for example, the glaciers were still nevertheless melting quite fast. And so he did some experiments, a series of studies on how different gases would trap heat And he discovered that in fact carbon dioxide was tending to trap heat inside the Earth's atmosphere, and so he really postulated the greenhouse effect in 1858, so a long, long time before we became very, very much aware of it.
I don't know which of you can answer for me what an ultraviolet catastrophe is. I'm presuming it has nothing to do with a bad tanning bed. I'm sure it's something else, or perhaps not. Which of you will answer that for me?
I'll let Dennis. Dennis can tell you about that.
So, you know, as we there's an element of the schoolboy in me, and you know, when I heard ultraviolet catastrophe, I thought of some mad scientist who was trying to obliterate the universe using only light or something. I thought, fantastic. But then when we looked into it, we discovered a 19th century very academic debate between physicists like Lord Rayleigh and Max Planck, among others, about the perfect black body. And you know, this was not at all any plan to destroy the universe. In fact, but nevertheless, there was a catastrophe, and that was a theoretical catastrophe or a catastrophe because they couldn't work it out. For some reason, their calculations said that a perfect black body would radiate in the once it got to the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, it would radiate at an impossibly high level of energy, and this would create a sort of catastrophe. And they knew that this wasn't the case, and so they had to redo the maths. And it gets, although, you know, obviously I was disappointed because it wasn't a sort of plan to destroy the universe. It was it became interesting because Max Planck, who was the man who finally solved the maths and got rid of the ultraviolet catastrophe, he used these maths then to develop quantum physics, which has become the foundation stone of modern physics. So it's a fascinating story that begins almost as a little academic debate between physicists.
Those are the sort of things that you'll be talking about further then in the lectures that you'll be taking part in. Yeah. And yes, it's hugely important. The audience is important here again. The lectures run online from the 5th to the 11th of July. Anne Cleary and Dennis Connolly speaking to me there. They're pre-recorded, the lectures themselves, but then you're doing a live Q&A 11 a.m. on the 12th. That's next Sunday. Also online from Paris. So as ever, the School of Looking, the audience is the key, and you can find out full details on junctionfestival.com. Callan Wink has had short stories published in The New Yorker, Granta, Playboy and the Best American Short Stories Anthology. His first collection, Dog Run Moon, was published in 2017, and he has just released his debut novel, August, and he joins me now from his home in Montana. You had that debut collection, or that collection of short stories, Dog Run Moon, great acclaim for that. It was one of those stories, in fact, that grew into this novel, Callan.
Yeah, that's true. It was the story Breatharians, kind of about a boy growing up in the Midwest, kind of a family sort of falling apart. The novel follows the same family and proceeds with the boy's life until about the age of 20.
A breatharian now is not something I know a lot about, and I don't think a lot of people will know a lot about. You might explain what it is.
I mean, it was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing in the story, but I mean, the premise of breatharianism is that one can live off of nothing but air and maybe clean thoughts. I don't know, but the mother in the story is sort of dabbling in this, probably not seriously, but it is sort of a theme in the story.
And at what point along the way did you know with that story, when it was published in Dog Run Moon, did you know even as writing, when you were writing it, there's more in these characters, there's more in the character of Augie, or August, who gives his name to the novel, there's more in Bonnie, his librarian mother, and there's more in the father, and where that story goes in the novel?
Yeah, I think when I wrote the first story, I still had the characters kind of in my mind, and I wrote another story or two. And at a certain point, I realized I was writing a novel, as it was. So I kind of snuck up on the novel that way.
And the move from Michigan to Montana, we meet Augie, as his mother and father are breaking up. In fact, I'm not giving anything away by saying that. And there's a shift in location for Augie and his mother to Montana, which mirrors a shift in location that you had yourself. Is there any sense that we have a Romana Clef on our hands here?
I think. Well, I found that writing novels are quite difficult, and this was my first published novel, but I had written a few others that were maybe unsuccessful that are just in my hard drive on my computer. And anyway, I've just found that writing about places I know just gives me an end to the story. If I'm starting from a place that I have no familiarity with, it's almost like I don't even know where to begin. So at least for this first one, I felt more comfortable in that way. It allowed me to kind of deal with the characters without having to maybe reimagine a whole landscape or do a lot of research and things like that. Yeah,
you could look out the window if you needed to find something to describe, I suppose.
Right.
But
right.
one of the really striking aspects of this book, and it starts very early on with the young Augie sent out to deal with a load of feral cats with an iron bar. There's a level of violence that starts from a very early stage of the book, and it's almost as if acts of violence beget further acts of violence. We move from there, you know, we have 9/11 happens in the middle of all of this. One of Augie's pals goes off to Afghanistan. He dies in a violent explosion. There's a commemoration for him. There's a young woman raped at that commemoration by some of the pals. And so it goes on. What were you exploring in exploring that need for violence in some of the characters and some of the male characters?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a need so much as it is just a reality. I think in this novel, I was trying to do justice to a certain upbringing in a certain place at a certain time. And if I were to write that novel in such a way that violence didn't exist or was avoided, then it wouldn't be an accurate depiction of how that place and time was, if that makes sense.
But is there a sense in which, you know, young men perhaps see older men, their role models, solving problems, solving conflict by violence, that they don't necessarily see other role models that show them other ways of solving issues and conflict issues?
Yeah, very much. I think this is a way of kind of achieving some level of manhood in rural America. I don't intend this novel to be a glowing report of that particular path towards manhood and what the end result is. But I think much of my goal with the novel was to try to explore why it is that some of these behavior patterns, especially in regards to violence, seem to perpetuate.
And to what extent did you find that you could, even if it is within a fictional world, or were you reflecting the real world as you see it? Because there are characters, one in particular I'm thinking of, where there's perhaps less of a macho quality to this young man. I'm thinking of a friend that Augie meets further on when he has moved to Montana. He makes friends with some people there, and one of those guys has a brother who is pretty androgynous type of character. Does that represent a kind of non-toxic masculinity? Is there hope for masculinity that we can get a type of expression of it that isn't toxic?
I guess I'm not really making a claim one way or the other than to have it be present in the story is important, because it is present in real life, even where I live, where that sort of expression of masculinity is not common or necessarily always, venerated, I guess. But it is present, and to write, again, these characters in this place without expressions of that would be inaccurate in my mind or unrealistic.
You are a keen fly fisher, I believe. Now, I am no expert fisherman, but fly fishing is the one that we see with all of those lovely balletic movements with the line flicking through the air and the fly just tipping off the top of the water. Whereas you've made Augie into a bait fisherman, much more prosaic, I would argue, perhaps, with just the perhaps live bait or a piece of metal bait on the end of the rod that drops into the water. there's not as much drama, not as much ballet involved. Does it tell us something about the character of the man that he is, or of the young boy, that he's a bait fisherman as opposed to a fly fisherman?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a certain level of impracticality that goes along with fly fishing. And I would say that August is not a character prone to dealing with impracticalities much.
But just tell me a little bit more about how the fly fisherman versus the bait fisherman side of that.
I suppose with bait fishing, it's very much results oriented. You're going fishing to catch a fish that you will then probably eat. Fly fishing, there's this element of art involved, I would say, and that is probably not something that August would allow himself to be attracted to.
All right. So I hear you are a fly fishing guide, not just a some kind of hobbyist when it comes to fly fishing, but you clearly have a very strong love of the poetry of that art form. Would you think of it as an art form, fly fishing?
I think there is some element of that. Yeah, it is. It's a practice, you know, not unlike other practices, sport, yoga, whatever. There's an element of that to it. So, yeah.
What about the fact that we are in Montana and the wide open plains of Montana? How mythologized is that area? I mean, you talk about at various points along the way, a river runs through it, as mentioned. Legends of the Fall is mentioned as well within the book. Has the state been mythologized? Has that part of America been mythologized in a way that you wanted to demythologize?
To some extent, there is a great deal of mythologizing that goes on about the American West in general. I mean, I think much of it stems from Hollywood movies, you know, and that sort of thing is present in fiction that I read occasionally. I feel like involving the landscape in the story is important, but you know, I think there's this tendency for maybe readers or critics in cities to look upon a writer from a rural location, and they may sort of have this thing like, well, as long as he's writing about, you know, pretty scenery, we're gonna give him a pass. But the minute he verges into, you know, having a thought or something like that, then we're going to, you know, deem him as being kind of a rube or a country guy. So there's some of that, but it's the landscape of the West is a great place to have a story. There's so many great Western writers out there.
Finally, one of the and I don't want to say how or where this pops up in the book, but a line comes about life is an act of trying to decipher what the hell happened in childhood. That's a big statement. Do you agree with the character who utters those words, or to whom you gave those words, that childhood is the key to understanding that is the key to understanding life?
I do feel like that's true to a certain extent. It is definitely true for the character that uttered it in the story.
And for Callan Wink?
Remains to be seen. I'm going to evade that question. But it's a good place to start when you're looking for answers. Maybe the only place to start, I think.
All right. It's a good job it's coming up to 8 o'clock, because I'd be prodding at you further to find out what you're not telling me. But thanks very much for speaking with us this evening. That's Callan Wink there speaking to us about his novel August, which is published by Granta. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.